crossing the street can be a dangerous undertaking in the best of circumstances. Now factor in your race.
Drivers were less likely to stop for black pedestrians, and the black pedestrians had to wait longer before they were able to cross the street.
I'm Mark Brody. Also today on the show, a different vision for the U.S.-Mexico border fence. Does membership have its privileges? Could the Arizona State Bar become voluntary for attorneys? A difference of opinion on the reasons behind a drop in abortions in the state. Southern Arizona gets some hot shots, and this SEGMENT.
It's true, a lot of people are reliant on spell check, but I know that a lot of people still really take good spelling into account.
Plus, setting a record most of us could probably live without, and saving neon. That and more on the show after a check of this hour's news. Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ. I'm Mark Brody in Phoenix. In Valley traffic, I-10 westbound, a collision blocks the on-ramp at 79th Avenue. And on the 101 northbound in the East Valley, a collision blocks the exit ramp at Indian School. Mostly sunny skies in the valley today with a high of 99 degrees, 9 degrees warmer than average. Clear skies tonight with overnight lows in the mid-70s. Mostly to partly sunny skies tomorrow with a high of 101. Right now in Phoenix, it's 96 degrees. The recent fatal shooting at Northern Arizona University has left some asking why, not only why a student would attack his classmates, but also how a weapon was on hand in the first place. KJZZ's Will Stone reports, according to public records, illegal possession of weapons is fairly rare at the state's three major universities.
Arizona's public universities are gun-free zones, unless it's stored in a car. That's where the shooter, who allegedly killed one student and injured three others at NAU, was keeping his firearm. NAU, Arizona State University, and the University of Arizona do not require a person to report if they have a gun in a vehicle on campus. A review of crime statistics shows there have been about 20 weapon law violations at those three institutions between 2012 and 2014, the majority at ASU's Tempe campus. Sergeant Philbert Barrera with the U of A Police Department says most violations they see are not because a student is found carrying a weapon, though.
It's not very frequent that we actually respond to somewhere on campus, like say in the residence hall, where we go there, we contact somebody with a gun and we arrest them because they're doing something wrong.
Barrera says much of their patrol work is geared toward keeping the campus safe from outsiders.
I would say the majority of them are contacts we make during traffic stops.
The crime statistics apply to any violation on campus or adjacent public property involving a weapon, not just those committed by students. Will Stone, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
The Arizona Supreme Court heard arguments this morning in the case of the so-called baseline killer. The appeal comes 4 years after he was sentenced to death. KJZZ's Alexandra Olgan reports.
Mark Goudeau was convicted of 9 murders and multiple other counts of sexual assault, kidnapping, and armed robberies against 33 victims. He terrorized South Phoenix, where he got his name, the Baseline Killer, between 2005 and 2006. After a 7-month trial, Goudeau was sentenced to death in 2011. In this automatic appeal, his lawyers are challenging the trial court on 17 issues. Among them, whether the search of his home was legal, if the state should have been able to present certain evidence, and whether the trial for all 74 crimes was too much for the jury. Alexandra Olgan, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
We're more than 2 weeks into fall, not that you'd know that by spending any time outside.
The heat! My God, the heat!
The valley could see record-breaking high temperatures this week. Joining me with more on this is meteorologist Hector Vasquez with the National Weather Service in Phoenix. And Hector, why is it so hot out right now?
Well, I guess a simple answer would be there's a large cyclonic storm off the Baja coast. It's circulating the winds in the mid and upper atmosphere cyclonically from the south, Mexico, into Arizona and kind of pumping up the thickness of the atmosphere. And so if you have a thicker atmosphere, you know, the pressure exerted on the surface is proportional to temperature, surface temperature. So that's why we're warm. The atmosphere is unusually thick. It's not unprecedented because the last day, recorded day of 100 degrees in Phoenix is October 23rd. But it does happen from time to time. And that low pressure system will eventually work its way into Arizona for a chance of showers Thursday, a better chance Friday. And then the jet stream from the Pacific will hit the west coast and deflect down into Arizona and give us more disturbances over the weekend. So we're looking for a pretty nice cooling trend, although high temperatures for the weekend will be pretty close to normal, which is about 89 degrees here in Phoenix.
Is it safe to say that this is really not indicative of what we can or should expect through the fall and winter? This is sort of a one-off situation here?
I would say that, yes.
Is there anything that can be gleaned from the fact that this kind of system is where it is right now and causing these temperatures in Arizona that we can use to forecast what's coming up?
Well, actually, this is an unusual weather system in the fact that it moved out of Western Canada last week and gave us our rain and temperatures in the 80s. And then it moved through Arizona from Western Canada into California, Arizona, and then it moved south into Mexico. And it migrated west to the Pacific, and it's coming around at us again. So it's the same system that came out of Western Canada. It's been modified a little bit because there is more subtropical moisture down in those lower latitudes. But basically, it's kind of an unusual situation.
Do you think after this week, that's it for triple digits for a while?
I'm pretty sure, yes.
So we can all breathe a sigh of relief?
Yeah, I think so.
Hector Vasquez is a meteorologist with the National Weather Service in Phoenix. A legislative committee is looking into changing the role of the Arizona State Bar. Right now, lawyers have to be members of the bar to practice in Arizona, but an ad hoc committee meeting next week could recommend making that membership voluntary. Bills to do that have failed in past legislative sessions, but advocates for the change say joining a group shouldn't be a requirement to work. For more on this, I'm joined by John Phelps, CEO and Executive Director of the State Bar of Arizona. So, John, why should attorneys have to join the bar to practice here?
Well, the principle that really is foundational to the whole idea of what's called the integrated bar, mandatory bar, is that lawyers are part of a profession. It's not just an occupation, but it's a profession that includes not only an obligation to a lawyer's clients, but a larger obligation that all lawyers have to the public. And that obligation includes the advancement of the administration of justice. It includes the development of law. So the idea is that as a member of this profession, nobody gets a waiver from those obligations, and that all lawyers must, as part of meeting that obligation, belong to the bar so that the bar is resourced properly and has the engagement of lawyers in meeting those responsibilities.
Some of the folks who are looking at potentially not making it mandatory point out that Arizona is a right-to-work state, that you don't have to belong to a union or other association to work in pretty much any other field in Arizona. Do you see that as a fair comparison?
No, I really don't see that as a fair comparison. The state bar is not a union. We don't do collective bargaining. We don't lobby with respect to fee amounts or even lawyer benefits or those kinds of things. We don't do the kinds of things that unions do. We don't take political positions. We don't support candidates for office. And so although on the surface that's an easy comparison, when you really start deconstructing that, it really falls apart pretty quickly.
Am I right that there are states in the U.S. where it is not required to be a member of the bar to practice?
There are. The majority of states out of 50, 32 states have a model similar to the State Bar of Arizona. So in those 32 states, if you are an active practicing attorney, you must be a member of the state bar. In the remaining 18 states, there's a different model, and there are variations on the theme, but generally the state bar is an association which is much like the traditional trade association. And so in those 18 states, much of the regulatory and compliance and some of the other aspects that we handle as a state bar are either handled by the court, the Supreme Court, or by other governmental entities.
There have been efforts in the past to basically do what this committee is looking to do now, which is make the state bar not mandatory for lawyers to be a member of. Do you expect that this year's effort will be different? We'll have a different result?
I don't think there'll be a different result. I think certainly there's a more concerted effort this year, and the committee is evidence of that. I'm in my seventh year in this role, and it hasn't been a perennial attack, but every year, every couple of years, we've seen an initiative come through the legislature. Last year, you're well aware of, almost made it through the House, but I think lost by one vote. You know, I'm not worried about it. I think certainly there's a more concerted effort, but I think I don't see a different result this year.
John Phelps is CEO and Executive Director of the State Bar of Arizona. John, thanks.
Thank you.
New figures released by the state show abortions on their way down in Arizona. A report from the State Department of Health Services shows an 11% decrease in abortion procedures in the state since 2011. But pro-life groups and abortion advocates disagree on the reasons why. KJZZ's Phil Latzman joins us to explain.
Well, Mark, one says it's a change in public attitude. The other says it's just a change in access. We'll start at the Center for Arizona Policy. Kathy Herrett is the president of that organization. So when you look at these new numbers showing abortion rates down, what do you think?
Well, the new abortion numbers show that when women are given information about alternatives to abortion, when they see an ultrasound picture of their preborn child, that women are making informed choices about whether or not to have an abortion. The good news is that when we give women information about the alternatives to abortion, when she sees an ultrasound picture, that a woman is more likely to choose life and not abortion.
So do you think this has to do with the 24-hour notice law that you your organization helped push through?
I think the collection of pro-life laws that have passed over the last few years have led to a decrease in abortion. The impact, the net effect of the pro-life laws is that women have information they need to make an informed choice about whether or not to have an abortion. It's a good day for Arizona. It's a good day for women when our laws protect them, when our laws ensure that they are given the facts about an abortion and the alternatives that are available.
Some people have said that perhaps more access to birth control provided by the Affordable Care Act has helped this number decrease. Do you agree with that?
Well, the drop in the abortion numbers is directly related to the pro-life laws that are providing for women who are considering an abortion.
So contraception, in your mind, doesn't have anything to do with this decrease?
Yeah, no. I don't know whether contraception has a. You know, to me, the most critical reason for the decrease is that women are being given the facts about abortion, that Americans increasingly are understanding that abortion does take the life of a preborn child and that abortion carries considerable harms to women.
As we reported on KJZZ last week, according to state records, since 2010, Arizona's Medicaid system paid for only 31 pregnancy terminations out of 50,000 performed since that time. So is the fact that it's so difficult and expensive in many cases making it harder for women to get the procedure and thereby reducing the numbers?
Well, regarding the pro-life laws that have passed in Arizona, I encourage people to stop and think about any time someone has a medical procedure, they're given information about the risk of the procedure, the alternatives that are available. They're usually given time to decide whether or not they want to follow through with that procedure. They're given trained medical personnel who excel at knowing how to perform those procedures. That is what has happened in the abortion industry in this state, that the pro-life laws simply ensure that women are given the facts about the procedure, the alternatives that are available, given time to make their decision before they actually have the procedure. So the net effect of the pro-life laws has been really to have abortion treated like most other medical procedures are treated in this state.
Kathy Herrett is with the Center for Arizona Policy. Kathy, thanks very much for your time.
Sure, thank you. Bye-bye.
For the pro-choice point of view, we bring in Brian Howard, who's president of Planned Parenthood Arizona. What do you make, Brian, of these new lower abortion rates in Arizona?
So first of all, it is important to know that both the number and the percent of abortions in urban Arizona, in other words, in Maricopa and Pima County, actually increased. So the number, the percent went up 1.9% and 200 more abortion procedures. The decline that we saw in 2014 was entirely the result of decline of women from rural counties. That decline was 26%. You know, I do think that that points to the impact that the restrictions that have been piled on abortion health care ever since 2009, year by year, where they are really taking a toll is in rural Arizona.
So what you're saying is that these women don't have the access in rural areas to get these procedures done?
I think the good news coming out of rural Arizona is that because of the difficulties that these restrictions have posed for women, is that there is an increasing awareness and use of emergency contraception and IUDs. And we are seeing that in our own health centers and among our patients, and we're also seeing that in public health data. And so women in rural counties know if they are at risk of unintended pregnancy, they will face extraordinary hurdles if they hope to seek abortion care.
So how can you prove that this is the case, that it's affecting rural women in ways that it's not affecting urban women in Arizona?
Because when you look at these numbers, the births went up in rural Arizona by exactly the same percentage as they did in urban. So in other words, the births remain unchanged. There is no distinction between urban and rural. The difference is in abortion, and in that instance, the impact has really been felt by rural women.
Brian Howard is president and CEO of Planned Parenthood Arizona. Brian, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you. Have a great day.
That was KJZZ's Phil Latzman. Just ahead, today on the Mexican border across from Arizona, an artist is attempting an ambitious and controversial project. She wants to paint the border fence to make it disappear.
And one day I just had this epiphany of like, you know, I can bring the sky down and erase it just using paint, you know, just painting it sky blue.
One artistic vision for the fence in 6 minutes on the show. Good afternoon. This is the show on KJZZ. I'm Mark Brody. In Valley traffic, I-10 westbound at 79th Avenue, a collision blocks the on-ramp there. On the 101 northbound in the East Valley, an accident blocks the exit ramp at Indian School. Sunny skies for the rest of the day today, still above average high temperatures. Look for a high today of 99. 90 is average for today. Right now it's sunny and 96 degrees at 221.
KJZZ is supported by MidFirst Private Bank, offering private banking, wealth and investment management, and trust services. More information at midfirstprivatebank.com. Member FDIC.
New research suggests there may be a racial bias at crosswalks. Researchers looked at marked crosswalks without signals in Portland, Oregon, and found race played a factor in whether drivers stopped to let people cross the street. Arlie Adkins is an assistant professor of planning in the College of Architecture, Planning, and Landscape Architecture at the University of Arizona and one of the researchers involved in the study. Arlie, how did you come up with the idea to look at this?
Yeah, so this idea for this study came up, you know, very informally talking with some colleagues about challenges that pedestrians face and, you know, being very vulnerable, especially when they are crossing roads. And talking with a social psychologist who looks at racial bias, we just started talking about how there was the potential for drivers to be influenced by these, you know, very subtle racial biases that they might hold when deciding whether or not to stop for a pedestrian at a crosswalk.
And what did you find?
So we found, based on a test that we ran in Portland, Oregon, that drivers were less likely to stop for black pedestrians, and the black pedestrians had to wait longer before they were able to cross the street.
Is it possible that that could have been because of something else, that racial bias didn't play into it at all?
It is possible, but we tried very carefully to control for as many things as we could. For example, we had all of the pedestrians. So these were trained members of our research team that were crossing the street. So we dress them all the same. We even train them in how to walk up to the sidewalk and what kind of body language to have while they were waiting to cross, so that we could try to really isolate the effects of race in this situation.
So what do those results tell you?
So they tell us that that there are disparities in how pedestrians are treated at crosswalks. What they don't tell us, you know, we can't make any conclusions here about how much that contributes to disparities that we see in terms of safety outcomes for people of color when they are walking. But it does tell us that there are these subtle differences that we think need to be part of the conversation when we're designing roadways and when we're educating drivers about how to and when to stop at crosswalks.
How would you design a roadway differently based on these results?
So we are currently doing a second phase of this research where we're looking at different types of crosswalk design. And in particular, we're looking at signage to see if signage, for example, a sign that reminds drivers that it's state law to stop for pedestrians in crosswalks, if that sort of shifts the decision to more of one of obeying the law rather than of extending some sort of courtesy to the pedestrian, and which would be more likely to see that racial bias enter into that courtesy decision rather than into the legal obligation decision.
At what point or how much research do you think you need to do to before you can say one way or the other that, yes, race does play a role in whether or not drivers stop for pedestrians, or no, it doesn't?
Well, we would really like to see more evidence from different cities. The types of roads in a place like Phoenix might be very different than where we tested. So we really want to see whether this holds up across different contexts. So that it's not just, you know, something isolated to the type of road that we were looking at. Even though we're not, you know, trying to make a direct link with some of the safety disparities that we have, I think one of the other potentials here is that these disparities that we're seeing in terms of cars stopping for Black pedestrians could also contribute to, you know, whether or not someone is going to decide to walk. And as you know, as we're trying to get more and more people to walk for the health, environmental, and economic benefits, these are the sorts of things that I think we need to be digging into as researchers.
So in theory, if you could tell pedestrians it will be safer for you, you will be able to cross the street safely, more people might be willing to do that.
Yes, and that they wouldn't be facing these inconveniences, even if not safety hazards, based on race.
Arlie Adkins is an assistant professor of planning in the College of Architecture, Planning, and Landscape Architecture at the U of A, and one of the researchers studying potential racial bias at crosswalks. The border fence has long been a topic of controversy. We've heard a lot lately from politicians who want to strengthen and expand the fence. But on the border today, across from Nogales, Arizona, one artist is working on a much different vision. KJZZ's Jude Joffe Block reports.
Ana Teresa Fernandez was born in Mexico, moved to San Diego as a child, and grew up going back and forth between the two countries. She's heard story after story of migrants who lost their lives trying to cross the border and of families divided by it. She came to resent the fence.
It became this thing where I just want to kick it and spit at it and like hit it, but I realized that that wasn't really going to do much. And so I took what was my weapon, which is paint.
In 2011, Fernandez went to Tijuana with a plan to paint the fence.
I just had this epiphany of like, you know, I can bring the sky down and erase it just using paint, you know, just painting it sky blue.
She picked a stretch of fence on the beach on the Mexican side, climbed up a ladder, and began to paint. She chose a shade of blue that would make it look like the fence disappeared into the sky and the Pacific Ocean behind it. And the illusion worked. As she was finishing up, a jogger came running up excitedly.
And this runner was all sweating. He's like, I get it! I get it! And I was like, I looked down from the ladder and I'm like, excuse me, sir, what do you get? He's like, it looks like it's gone from far away.
Arizona artist Francisco Flores was surprised when he stumbled on Fernandez's work while visiting Tijuana.
When I looked at the border, I saw a section of it missing, like in this weird perspective way. And then I realized it was a painting on the bars.
Fernandez says her goal is to inspire people to imagine what if the fence really did come down.
What happens if that political and physical divide, like, disintegrates? What does that mean? You know, do we have to be acknowledged as real humans, as people with personal and intimate stories?
Her goal is to expand the project into other parts of Mexico, this time some 370 miles east of her original painting, on a stretch of fence across from Nogales, Arizona. Lately, the Arizona border fence has become the subject of other artistic endeavors. This past weekend, an art collective launched a 2-mile-long sculpture of giant floating balloons over the Arizona town of Douglas and the Mexican town of Agua Prieta. Artist Cristobal Martinez says the work highlights the connections between the towns that transcend the fence.
When we got here to Douglas and Agua Prieta, we found a community bisected by the border, with a desire to want to work together and remember a time before the border fence.
There's a lot of symbolism when we talk about the wall, and has various meanings for different people.
Lisa Magana is a professor at Arizona State University's School of Transborder Studies. She says these art installations show the disconnect between political soundbites about the border fence and the more nuanced views of those who actually live there.
For people that live in border communities, I see the wall as sort of a reminder of transnational or transborder identity. And the wall sort of joins the two countries, and in some ways it creates its own separate, unique identity.
Jude Jaffe Block, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
For weeks, we've heard harrowing stories of people fleeing the war in Syria. So how bad must things be for these refugees when some of them are going back to Syria? Recently, the UN has seen a dramatic rise in numbers heading from the relative safety of neighboring Jordan back to war-torn Syria. The latest monthly figures were double those seen earlier in the year. The BBC's Yolande Nell reports.
There are dozens of Syrian refugees waiting inside this UN center, inside Zaatari camp. Many of them are families, and they've come here because they're planning to leave Jordan and go on a dangerous journey. But most here couldn't afford to go to Europe. Instead, they're heading home to Syria, to a war zone.
انت بتعرفي انه احتمال اذا رحتي ما بتقدري ترجعي تفوتي على الاردن؟
اي بعرف. UN workers give counselling. They say they've seen a big increase in Syrians heading home in the past few months. Sometimes there are hundreds in a day. Omar Al-Mohaisen tells them they shouldn't go back.
The first thing is no safe places in among Syria at all. There is no safe village, no free village considered from UNHCR perspective. The second thing is you can't return back to Jordan. It's a one-way ticket, so you will not be allowed at all to come back to Jordan.
We've seen all kinds of cases here. A single mother with three small children, a husband preparing to stay with his aging mother while his wife and daughters, one of them a newborn, go to her family in regime-held Damascus. Now there's a father and daughter who've just arrived at the registration point. Khaled and Ayat have invited me back to the home that they're about to leave. Just stepping inside. This was meant to be an apartment for three students, but there are eight people living here. Still, it costs 250 dinars a month. That's about $350. Now all the family's savings have gone. This year they've lost their free healthcare and food aid's been cut. Khaled can't work legally in Jordan, and he can't pay for Ayat to go to university. He's convinced all his children will have a better life in southern Syria, even as the fighting rages on.
It's been terrible. Shelling and barrel bombs almost every day. People dying. For the last 20 days, there's been talk of a truce.
But don't you worry that the situation could get violent again?
Yes, I can't deny I'm scared, but you only die when your time is up. We don't have a life here.
And this is what he's going back to. the sound of barrel bombs dropped by regime aircraft in southern Syria. The opposition Free Syrian Army says it can't protect people. Major Assam al-Rais believes Russian involvement in the war will only increase the bloodshed.
We are expecting that by the Russian involvement, the situation will be more complicated. These airstrikes will be heavier, stronger, more accurate, and it will attack and kill lots of civilians. That's why we advise our refugees not to go back to Syria now, because the situation will be more dangerous.
But more and more families are preparing to return to a conflict that shows no sign of ending. From this bus stop, Jordan provides transport to the Syrian border. Those who cross aren't allowed to turn back. Everyone on board this bus has been told they've got just a one-way ticket. These are Syrians who've had to make a dreadful choice, and they've opted to go back to the horrors of home instead of facing hunger and misery here.
That's the BBC's Yolan Nell in Jordan. Coming up, signs, signs, everywhere a sign, but the neon ones really stand out.
You drive by the cheese and stuff sign, especially at night, and you just want to stop and say, wow.
Bright lights, big city, that's ahead, it's the show. Good afternoon in Phoenix. I'm Mark Brody, checking Valley traffic. 101 northbound in the East Valley. A crash on the exit ramp at Indian School has that area blocked. Also on I-10 westbound, a collision blocks the on-ramp at 79th Avenue. We're looking for sunny skies for the rest of the afternoon with a high of 99 degrees. That would be 9 degrees warmer than average. Clear tonight, overnight lows in the mid-70s. Sunny tomorrow with a high of 101. It's 96 degrees at KJZZ at 235.
KJZZ is supported by Polsinelli, a national full-service law firm focused on understanding client challenges and providing legal guidance grounded in business acumen. Polsinelli.com. Real challenges, real answers.
In KJZZ news, a new study suggests collectors and black market trade are putting 30% of rare cactus species at risk of extinction. As KJZZ's Carrie Young reports, the research was published in the journal Nature Plants this month.
The study was completed by an environmental organization known as the International Union for Conservation of Nature. The group collected data from around the world, but found most of the impacted cacti were located in North and South America. Jan Skipper, a conservation biologist from Arizona State University, contributed to the study. He says one species is the golden barrel cactus, which is commonly found in the valley.
So although it's incredibly abundant in some suburbs around Phoenix, if you go to where it's actually from in Querétaro in Mexico, you would find almost none left in its native range. So it's a very interesting shift, and it doesn't do as well further north up here.
Skipper adds, just like any ecosystem, when one feature disappears, the impacts can trickle down to other plants and animals. Carrie Young, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
The Bureau of Land Management is creating a new hotshot firefighting crew, which will be based in southern Arizona. And the BLM says it's planning to recruit as many military veterans as possible for the 20-member crew. Adam Milner is a spokesman with the BLM in Tucson.
The establishment of the crew is really in response to a national increase in wildfire, both in the number of fires and the severity of those fires. And we just recognize that we need additional skilled personnel to handle that situation. The decision next is a matter of where you locate a crew like that, and Southern Arizona does not have a crew currently. There has been a crew in the past, a hotshot crew, but there isn't one now. And when you combine the need in that area in terms of previous wildfires, and then we have a really good relationship with the U.S. Army at Fort Huachuca, it really made it a natural fit to locate the crew there.
Why isn't there a hotshot crew in Southern Arizona now?
You know, there are about 11 crews statewide. Most of them are operated by the U.S. Forest Service. There was a crew that was disbanded in 2014 for financial reasons in Southern Arizona. But just historically, it's been an area without a dedicated hotshot crew. They've mostly been located in the more forested parts of the state. But as you know, Southern Arizona and Eastern Arizona have experienced their fair share of wildfires.
Are there trained firefighters who can jump onto this hotshot crew? Do you need to train people or find people who have this kind of training?
You know, there are folks out there with these qualifications, but this is an elite crew, and it requires some preparation. So it begins as a Type 2 crew initially for the 2016 season. So that means, not the highest level of certification. And then there's a training program. There's skills that are developed. And then we hope that within 2 or 3 years, they get their full Type 1 hotshot certification.
Why is it that you've decided to really try to recruit veterans for this service?
You know, this is part of a national focus from the BLM and the other agencies to bring military veterans into the workforce because, you know, it's a really natural fit. Military veterans are highly skilled. They know how to be safe. They know how to be organized. And a lot of those skills translate really well to a wildfire type situation. So it's really a natural fit. And we were creating a new hotshot crew. We really wanted to focus on military veterans and bringing them into that workforce. We hope that in 2 or 3 years, the crew is made up 100% of veterans, and we're already seeing a lot of interest.
You mentioned that Southern Arizona had a crew like this before, but was disbanded because there wasn't enough money. Are you confident that there will be enough money this time to keep this crew around for a while?
For sure. Yeah, that was a non-federal crew that was located out of a fire district here down in Tucson. And so this is really coming from a national priority to do this. We have our National Interagency Fire Center, which is based in Boise. It's all the agencies at the federal level working together to prioritize where resources are needed. So the decision to bring this crew and establish it in Southern Arizona is a commitment to keep it around and make sure that resource is available for our state.
Adam Milner is a spokesman for the BLM in Tucson. We've been talking about the new hotshot crew that will be based at Fort Huachuca in Southern Arizona. Adam, thank you.
Appreciate it. Thank you very much.
They're bright, flashy, and colorful. Some think they're garish, others call them retro, and they're disappearing. Neon signs used to line valley streets in the early to mid-20th century. Today, just a handful remain. The show's Annika Klein sheds some light on the effort to save those last signs, which is getting more urgent and more pricey.
In a little brick building at the end of this strip mall on Camelback and Central is a shop called Cheese and Stuff Deli. You might miss it if it weren't for the sign. A giant neon globe that's been here since the 40s.
If you drive around the valley, you see these small plastic backlit signs.
Douglas Town is with the Arizona Vintage Sign Coalition, a group of volunteers trying to preserve classic neon signs.
But you drive by the Cheese and Stuff sign, especially at night, and you just want to stop and say, wow.
For years, though, the globe was dark. Repairs would have cost the deli at least a couple $1,000s. Then, last month, it glowed again, thanks to this man.
Dane Christensen. I'm the owner, president of Christie Sign Company.
Christensen's dad made the Cheese and Stuff sign. He says that's what motivated him to repair it for free. But freebies are rare in the neon business, especially now that LED is the cheaper, easier option. Christensen says the popularity of neon lights flickered out after the 50s.
And it almost disappeared. Now it's kind of coming back again. It's now the thing to have. You've got a neon sign, you're really something.
He still wants to repair old neon signs. His shop even has all the tools, something he says is rare these days. The one problem? The sign owner has to be willing and able to pay the higher price for neon work. Many can't, like Jacob Johnson, who owns Watson's Flower Shop on Apache Boulevard in Tempe.
My great-grandparents started the flower shop in 1927.
If the Cheese and Stuff sign was big, the Watson's Flower sign is colossal, with pink flowers the size of truck tires. Johnson says the sign is more than 30 feet tall, or at least it was when it stood. A microburst last year knocked the sign back onto the building. Johnson's just glad it didn't fall forward onto the actual lights.
It would have been a complete loss.
Even in the 1950s, when the sign was built, it didn't come cheap.
My grandmother bragged about how much money she paid for the sign. She paid about $8,000 for the sign. And back then, she bragged that you can buy a new house.
Now the flower shop is looking at an estimated $65,000 in repairs, almost enough to buy a house today. The Johnsons started a crowdfunding campaign for the sign, but have only raised a fraction of the costs. For now, the sign lies in the shop's yard. But for preservationists like Douglas Town, just knowing that it survived is a success. And he's feeling optimistic.
People are starting to realize that, hey, these are valuable. These are public art. They're landmarks for the community. We can't let any more of these disappear.
The more neon signs do disappear, the more people start seeing them in a different, more treasured light. It's the show. I'm Anika Klein.
Good afternoon. This is the show on KJZZ. Under sunny skies, it's 96 degrees at 2:45.
KJZZ is supported by Universal Pictures, presenting Steve Jobs, the new film from the screenwriter of The Social Network and the director of Slumdog Millionaire, now playing in select theaters everywhere October 16th.
If the shame and disappointment of losing your grade school spelling bee is still with you, you've got a chance to redeem yourself. The Asian American Journalists Association is hosting a spelling bee for adults tomorrow night at Changing Hands Bookstore in Tempe. It's a fundraiser for the group. To spell out the details, I'm joined by AAJA President Amy B. Wang, who's also a reporter for the Arizona Republic.
It is open to anybody. It's going to be tomorrow, Wednesday, October 14th, at the Changing Hands in Phoenix. The spelling part of it, we'd really like people to sign up ahead of time. And it's going to work just like your childhood spelling bee worked, pretty much. People get on stage. I mean, it's not meant to be scary or anything, but it is, you know, I understand it is intimidating for a lot of people. But the spellers will be on stage, and you'll step up to the mic and get your word. And when you get your word, you have the chance to ask for its definition, for it to be used in a sentence. And if you're really hardcore and have been studying your Latin roots or whatnot, you could ask for the language of origin, just like in the Scripps National Bee. And if you spell it correctly, you move on. And if you don't, then you're out.
Who is tasked with picking the words with which people will be spelling?
Oh, that was me.
So how did you pick? I mean, did you just like go through a dictionary and say, oh, that looks hard. That looks hard. Too easy. Let's use that one.
Well, yes. I've been taking words from various. There are some lists online and also study materials from the Scripps National Bee. I will say I covered the Scripps National Bee this past spring, and the words will not be of that level because those kids are quite extraordinary and have been studying, many of them have been studying for years. So these will probably be words that you've seen before. A lot of the words, a few of the words actually are just from conversations we've had with people where, you know, we'll mention the spelling bee and they'll say, oh, in fifth grade, the word I got out on was, you know, everybody has that word that they got out on and still remember 20 years later.
So I understand that you brought some sample words for me to test out.
I did.
Okay, let's have at it.
Okay, and remember, you can ask for the definition or for it to be used as a sentence.
But I can't ask you to actually spell it for me.
Yeah, no, I can. Okay, and much like it'll go tomorrow, I'll start out with perhaps an easier word, and then they'll get progressively more difficult.
Okay.
As the words go on.
So hopefully, I get this first one right then.
It's KJZZ.
That one I think I can handle.
No. So your first word is flower.
Flower. Which flower are you asking for on that?
So this flour is powder made from a grain, especially wheat, that is used in cooking for making bread, cakes, and the like.
All right. Flour, F-L-O-U-R, flour.
Yes, you're right. So we'll go on to our next word, which is tabernacle.
Tabernacle. T-A-B-E-R-N-A-C-L-E, tabernacle.
Yes, that's correct. I think that was the word I got out on in eighth grade.
In eighth grade?
Yeah.
And you still remember it all these years later.
I do remember it all these years. It may or may not, for those listening and coming tomorrow, be part of tomorrow's bee. And the next word we'll go to is fluorescent.
Fluorescent. I know there's a C in there somewhere. F-L-O-U-R-E-S-C-E-N-T, fluorescent.
That's incorrect.
Ah.
It is F-L-U-O-R-E-S-C-E-N-T.
Ah, I knew there was a C in there somewhere.
Mm-hmm. The U and the O are switched at the beginning.
Do you consider yourself a good speller?
I'm okay. I like spelling. I like, you know, looking at words and seeing where they originated from. But I won't be spelling tomorrow.
And I ask because I think for a lot of adults, I mean, yes, a lot of us went through spelling bees as kids, but as adults, we kind of rely on the red squiggly line that comes up when we're typing in a Microsoft Word document to tell mm-hmm. us if we've screwed something up. We don't necessarily think about it anymore because of technology. There's autocorrect. There's all sorts of stuff to help us to become better spellers.
Sure. That's very true. And I think that when we brought this up, there was a little bit of nostalgia for spelling bees because it was something that a lot of people participated in growing up. I think it's true. A lot of people are reliant on spell check, but I know that a lot of people still really take good spelling into account.
Amy B. Wang is a reporter with the Arizona Republic and president of the Asian American Journalists Association. Amy, thank you.
Thank you so much, Mark.
It's the show for Tuesday, October 13th. I'm Mark Brody, along with the takeaways, John Hockenberry.
Here's a bit of news from 1980 and songwriter slash reporter Joe Jackson looking sharp.
It's so good to be back here in England, where you have a sophisticated standard of journalism, you know, with papers like the New Musical Express. And of course, the Sunday papers.
Mother doesn't go out anymore. Just sits at home and rolls her spastic eyes.
Joe Jackson's band, just like the even angrier sounding Clash in the early 80s, made their songs about the news of the day. Unusual for pop bands, but then Joe Jackson has always been unusual.
I once had a beer with Joe Strummer, and he told me that when him and Mick Jones were writing those songs for the Clash, a lot of the time they were taking the piss, as we say in England, you know, making fun. And when the rock critics would analyze them and take them very seriously as political and social commentary, they would be cracking up laughing. And I completely related to that.
Jackson loves to shrug off serious inquiries about his songs, but no one doubts he's a serious musician and a lyricist who excels exploring the territory of band leaders like Duke Ellington, poets like Walt Whitman, traveling America and commenting on all its good and bad. Jackson's first original song album in 7 years displays his love of songs, his eye-rolling annoyance at pop formulas, but delivers his sharp eye for detail and storytelling that have made Joe Jackson a musical legend for more than 30 years.
There's three classic themes of pop songwriting. One is, I'm so happy because I'm in love.
I'm in love and you.
And number two is, I'm devastated because my baby left me. And the third one is, oh, to hell with it, let's just dance and have a good time.
We can dance, we can dance,
that's it,
there's nothing wrong with any of those themes.
No.
You know, but I try to think of something else. That's all.
I mean, when you do go into some of those themes, you find a different way of talking about it. Let's take, for instance, something breaking us in two.
Don't you feel like trying something new? Don't you feel like breaking out or breaking us in two?
That's not a breakup song. It's about, I don't know, it's sort of about the complexities of a relationship.
Yeah, yeah, like no matter how close close you get to someone, there's always something that holds you apart. I think I'm sort of attracted to slightly ambiguous themes, you know, or bittersweet. A lot of my songs are bittersweet, I think. And it's interesting because some people hear them as sad and other people hear them as happy. And to me, they're both.
Hometown. Is that about a particular town?
Yeah, it's about my hometown, which is Portsmouth on the south coast of England. But that was a kind of deliberate exercise in nostalgia. I thought, can I write a nostalgic song? You know, I always think of it as sort of like a recreational drug. It's all right to indulge in a little bit, but, you know, you've got to be careful.
I mean, I searched and searched your work. There is no evidence at all that you have any nostalgia for Portsmouth.
No. Yeah, it's a pretty horrible place, really. I mean, but at the same time, only your hometown is your hometown.
Right.
You know, and I still go back quite a lot, and I still have some friends there and family and so on.
I associate your early work with an emotional portrait of Thatcher's England.
Oh, my God, really?
Not like the Clash, who were very, you know, sort of out there and political. It seemed to me that you really captured a sense of, I don't know, heartbreak that came in Thatcher's England.
I think you give me too much credit, actually. I mean, thanks, but
I give a lot of people too much credit.
I mean, so much of what I wrote back then was very tongue-in-cheek and humorous, but it was seen as being angry, I think, because that was the zeitgeist of the time, and people saw what they were looking for.
This album is a passionate reemergence for you. It's set in different places, attempting to capture and portray four different cities and styles of music.
If it wasn't for you, my friend, why should everything be such a fuss? We were brought up in a boring town. So you say, and I agree, you're a prize, but not for me.
The idea of recording in different cities came quite late in the day because I had a sort of unmanageable pile of songs that was accumulating. And I was looking for some kind of way to organize them. And the idea surfaced in a conversation I was having with my manager, actually, that maybe I didn't have to do an album. You know, maybe I could do an EP or just do three or four songs and then move on and do another three or four. And I thought that was quite an interesting idea. Started thinking about places that I might like to work and musicians that I might like to work with. And the musicians actually were more important than the places. I mean, they're all cities that I know very well, you know, but the main thing that took me to those places was the musicians.
What are the places?
New York, New Orleans, Berlin, and Amsterdam.
How do you see an arrangement? Because I think of you as such an arranger. Part of the composing process is the arranging process.
How
do you see the landscape of the instrumentation and the things that you'll do, particularly when you decide to change it up?
Sometimes when you decide not to do certain things, it makes you use your imagination more. I mean, for a long time, I toured with just a trio, just me and bass and drums. And it's so interesting because when you're limited, it forces you to use your imagination more and it just seems to get bigger and bigger. You know, the more I worked with the trio, the freer it seemed, the more possibilities there were.
And you were on keyboards?
Yeah.
And does it make your piano playing better because you have to use it to do everything?
I think I've gotten generally better, actually. In recent years, I think my piano playing's improved quite a lot.
Well, is there something limiting about the genre? Right now?
Of what?
Of popular song, of albums. I mean, I associate your work with, you really loved the kind of novelistic quality of an album, of an LP.
Yeah.
And now that's kind of disrupted with all the downloading and stuff.
Yeah. I mean, it sort of is and it isn't. It's very confusing, really, because people keep talking about how the album is dead, and yet people keep making albums. And I think that the concept of an album, regardless of what it is physically or whether it is a physical object or not, I think the concept of an album is still there, you know, as far as it being an artist's, like, a kind of statement of where they're at that point in time, and something bigger than just a song. I think somehow the idea of an album still exists.
Thanks a lot, Joe.
Thank you.
That's The Takeaways' John Hockenberry. Joe Jackson's new album, Fast Forward, is out now. I am joined now in studio by Steve Goldstein, host of KJZZ's Here and Now, among many other things. And Steve, member of Congress on tomorrow year's program.
Mark, David Schweikert is going to tell us tomorrow who will be the next U.S. Speaker of the House. Oh, of course, well, he may be wrong, I suppose, but he's going to tell us.
And it probably won't be him, right?
We don't think so at this point, yes. Doesn't sound like any Arizona is in the finals for this.
Okay. Also, we've been talking a lot both on this program and on Here and Now about education funding in Arizona. More on that tomorrow, yes?
Yeah, we're going to look into how the conversation has changed with Lisa Graham Keegan, former State Senator Rich Crandall, about it used to be sort of, does Arizona need to spend more money? Now it's about how much more we need to spend.
Seems like a real shift in the conversation, possibly if you're a supporter of more money for education. Seems like probably a good thing, yes?
Sure seems that way, yeah.
One last thing that we should mention, you'll be speaking in verse tomorrow?
It's someone who reminds me a lot of you, Mark. He's Arizona's poet laureate. Alberto Rios will also be on the program, talk about his latest book of poetry and other things as well.
Steve Goldstein, host of KJZZ's Here and Now, tomorrow morning at 11. Steve, thanks.
Thank you, Marky.
The show is produced by our senior producers, Sarah Ventry and Jimmy Jenkins, with help from Bruce Drummond, Anika Klein, Nadine Arroyo-Rodriguez, Regina Revazova, and Tiara Vian. Sky Shout and Domenico Nicosia are the digital team. Our managing editor is Tracy Greer. News director Al Macias. Executive producer is John Hoban. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Mark Brody in Phoenix. This is member-supported KJZZ FM Phoenix and HD. It's 3 o'clock.
KJZZ is supported by Honor Health, still locally owned and not-for-profit. Scottsdale Healthcare and John C. Lincoln Health Network have merged and are making healthy personal. More information can be found at honorhealth.com.